Hello and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. My name is Mark Williams. I'm the contributing editor to Ship.Energy, your free web-based guide to shipping's path to decarbonisation. We're delighted this week to have as our guest Dr. Lucy Gilliam of the NGO Transport and Environment. Transport and Environment is an organisation that's been researching and reporting the impact of transport on our environment since 2007. It's a non-profit organisation. It's politically independent. It's a member of the Clean Shipping Coalition, which has observer status at the IMO. And it is represented on a number of industry groups across land, sea and air transport. Dr. Gilliam joined Transport and Environment in 2017, and her team there works on developing policy to reduce the impact shipping and aviation have on the environment. They work with EU institutions, with the IMO, with the International Civil Aviation Organization, the UNFCCC, and other bodies on a range of policies, including emissions targets, market-based measures, research and innovation, and taxation. Now, Dr. Gilliam is an experienced sailor, a very keen sailor, and prior to joining T&E, was a founding director of a company called Expedition, an all-female company that still runs research voyages investigating issues like plastics pollution of the oceans. Dr. Gilliam's also been an advisor to the UK government's Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and was awarded her PhD from the University of Reading in the UK for her research into DNA profiling tools to explore the relationship between biodiversity and soil function. I should also say that Dr. Gilliam and I sat on an environmental issues in shipping roundtable discussion at Antwerp Excel, I think 1 or 2 years ago, certainly in life pre-COVID. Anyway, Dr. Gilliam, Lucy, welcome to the podcast. Very welcome. It's great to have you aboard. Now, I've done a brief introduction about transport and environment, but I think you'll probably be able to tell our listeners who don't know you yet, in a much more eloquent way, what goes on at T&E and what you do there than I can. So perhaps you could introduce yourself.
Yes, certainly. So I've been at Transport and Environment for 3 years now, and we're a Brussels-based think tank slash policy slash campaign organisation. We're a member-based organisation, so we represent 63 NGOs across Europe who are working on broad environmental topics, but our focus at Transport and Environment is on the transport sector. So we're looking at shifting policy, climate policy and air pollution related to cars, trucks, ships, planes. We've recently expanded to also cover fuels and sustainable finance. So most of our work is at an EU level, developing EU regulations, but a small part of our work is also UN-based. So for shipping and aviation, that means we're working at the International Maritime Organization and at the International Civil Aviation Authority. So my shipping work in the team, I'm mostly doing our campaigns work. So a lot of outreach with our members, and I'm heavily involved in the Clean Arctic Alliance campaign, where we're calling for a ban on the use of heavy fuel oil in the Arctic. And I'm also heavily involved in cruise campaigns and our EU shipping campaign. So that's a little bit of background about transport and environment.
Thanks for that. I didn't know about the Arctic thing. I wanted to pick up on that. It must be 7 or 8 years ago when I was working for a shipbroker in London as the group head of research. And we had a phone call from the BBC, and I was thrown into a taxi and whisked off to Portland Place and shoved in front of the TV cameras to be on the BBC News. And as a bulk carrier had just done a sailing through the Arctic from Japan to Europe, carrying, I think it was iron ore, bizarrely. I think it was a test run. And the BBC wanted to know, is this the end for the Suez Canal? Will everything go via the North Pole now? And of course, the answer was no. There were about 20 Arctic voyages that year compared to 17,000 Suez Canal transits. But is your research into the Arctic suggesting that are you finding there's a lot more interest in people using the Northern Sea Route?
Yeah, definitely. And that's part of the reason why we've got our campaign is we're deeply concerned about the increase in shipping in the Arctic, and the fact that the ships currently operating in the Arctic are mostly burning heavy fuel oil, and that there's huge risks, basically. If heavy fuel oil were to spill in the Arctic, it would be almost impossible to clean up. So that's one of our kind of biggest concerns, is HFO spill risk. But also we're very concerned about the emissions from the ship themselves, black carbon. Now, black carbon is like the second most potent greenhouse element of shipping pollution, and it's particularly problematic when you burn fuel and create black carbon in the Arctic, because these little tiny soot particles end up falling on ice and accelerating ice loss there. We've got two main big asks as to why we want the HFO to be banned in the Arctic. It's to reduce the spill risk, and it's also to reduce black carbon emissions. And what we're seeing is that shipping in the Arctic is increasing rapidly. This is because the Arctic is melting rapidly, and we've just been through the Arctic sea ice minimum. This is the point where the Arctic ice is the lowest for the year, and that's happened in the last couple of weeks, in September, that it's a sea ice minimum. And this is basically a sign that the Arctic is changing rapidly, and these sea routes are opening up. If we see these sea routes open up and more ships there, then we're going to have more HFO risk, and we're going to have more black carbon emissions.
So clearly there's an urgent environmental situation developing in the Arctic, not just because of the melting of the sea ice, and a commercial issue as well. And of course, it's a much shorter route from Asia to Europe to go via the Northern Sea Route than it is via Suez or Panama.
Yeah. And that's why we're working at the IMO to get a ban in place before we see that acceleration in Arctic shipping, so that if ships were to continue sailing there, that they would be switching to cleaner fuels and therefore protecting that environment.
I think fortunately for the Arctic environment, still it's commercially a bit of a flip the coin at the moment, because although you have a shorter route, which would mean burning less fuel and emitting less CO2 if you were traveling Asia Europe, you've also got the issue of having to pay for the Russian nuclear icebreakers. So commercially, I don't think it's particularly viable to switch the entire global fleet, say, of container ships going on Asia Europe from Suez to the Northern Sea Route.
No, indeed. And I just really hope that wouldn't happen anyway, because the Arctic is such an extraordinary and delicate environment. And it's basically the Arctic environment plays a key role in determining the stability of the whole Earth's, you know, biosphere. So there are lots of reasons why we shouldn't really be particularly increasing shipping there. Mm-hmm.
Get back to a sort of more the decarbonisation thing after my, sorry, it was I who diverted you.
Yeah.
Getting back to the decarbonisation thing, have you seen the pictures of the new CMA CGM Jacques Sardé, this new container ship? It looks fabulous with its green and blue paint job.
Yeah.
And it has a high pressure dual fuel engine, LNG engine. So I think Transport and Environment got some publicity last year. You put a paper out talking about LNG's well-to-wake emissions.
Indeed, yeah.
One of your conclusions in that paper was that there was some advantage to these high-pressure dual-fuel twin-stroke engines. So you're pleased to see people like CMA CGM being early adapters doing their best to try to move the decarbonisation agenda along?
Not really. Our position is that LNG is really the wrong pathway for decarbonising shipping. The reasons for this is, as you've already alluded to, it's actually a very small carbon saving, even if you've got the best available technology. So if you've got the high pressure engines, then you might see a small reduction in the overall greenhouse gas footprint. But actually, the majority of engines right now are low pressure engines. So they actually have... When you look well to wake, their emissions are higher than using the conventional fuels. Also, LNG requires massive investment into bunkering infrastructure and to create these LNG compatible ships. So they're not going to be fully decarbonizing the sector. So our position is that these are going to end up being stranded assets, and that we really need to think very carefully about where we're spending our money, particularly if it's publicly funded money, on which will be the technology that will get us to the ultimate goal, which is that we need to be like fully decarbonizing shipping by the mid-century. So, I mean, I guess there are probably some small benefits from like these new engines. Potentially, you know, there are engines that right now could burn LNG, but in the future could be burning hydrogen. You know, okay, fine, but really, we need to be thinking of like, where's the end goal? How are we going to spend our money? And we would say that LNG is not the right solution for that.
So, in the long term, we need to be moving beyond hydrocarbons altogether. And I
exactly
agree with that. The question, I suppose, the discussion point is, to what degree can LNG contribute to cutting carbon today whilst we come up with the technology that doesn't really exist yet, does it, to completely decarbonize the shipping industry?
Well, I think you talk about like what can be done today, but like even today, if we were to, in the short term, use LNG, we would be spending huge amounts of money on infrastructure, and that infrastructure can't necessarily be used for the long-term solutions. So, you know, we know that hydrogen, ammonia, they are technologies that potentially are a solution if they're scaled, and are also going to require infrastructure investment. So I think it's more a case of saying, let's hold fire, let's make ships as efficient as we can. Technologies like electrification, so that you can do peak shaving, you can make your ship as efficient as possible. Do that now, because that's the kind of technology that can take you in a stepwise process to a fully decarbonized ship, because then you've got electric drivetrain. Now it can be powered by fossil fuels, but it can in the future be, you can be creating that energy from fuel cells, for example. You know, one of the other things that comes up in this LNG debate is they say, okay, well, we're using fossil LNG now, but in the future, we could be using synthetic or electro or biomethane. Our answer to that is that for the electromethane, this is the synthetically manufactured methane where you're taking hydrogen and then you're taking CO2 and you're adding some carbon to it to make your methane, your LNG. That's hugely inefficient process. You know, you're losing energy in order to add that carbon. Why not just burn that hydrogen in the first place? So that's sort of number one there. If we're talking about biomethane, there's just simply not enough feedstock available to decarbonize all the sectors that are after a substitute for fossil LNG. So for example, you know, we've got the heating industry, you know, how we heat our homes. There's not even enough biomethane available to decarbonize housing. So why do we think that there's going to be enough surplus biomethane to power ships? So again, we kind of say, you know, this isn't a long-term solution, and we need to focus right now on the solutions that get us to our 2050 and beyond goals.
You've mentioned some of the alternatives in all of that. Let's talk about hydrogen for a moment then. Do you think hydrogen is going to be the answer? Because the European Union has said that hydrogen can be the answer for industries that are hard to decarbonize.
Indeed, yep.
It's going to be the way forward in the long term?
Well, I think for shipping, the overall picture is there isn't one silver bullet. So I think it's about getting the right technology at the right scale. So what I mean by that is the right technology for the ships, the size of the ship and the route that they're sailing and the cargo that they've got. So it's not like hydrogen will be the right solution, the cost-effective solution for all of those different ship types. But certainly I think for the longer distance vessels, then hydrogen or forms of hydrogen like ammonia are going to be the solution there. For shorter distances, then I think from an efficiency point of view, it's way more efficient to be charging a battery and then using that battery to create propulsion energy than it is to take hydrogen and either burn it or put it in a fuel cell. You'll get about 80% of your energy back out if you're charging a battery versus maybe about 40% if you're doing hydrogen. So basically you need almost half the amount of windmills, as it were, to have a battery ship than you do hydrogen. But the problem with batteries is the range and it's the size of the battery. So there is like a limit there. But for coastal traffic, for ships that are on regular routes, you know, they're pinging backwards and forwards between certain ports of call, then electrification is going to play a key role there. Then in addition to that, you know, it's important to think about the overall efficiency and are there technologies that you can use on your ship in order to make sure you're just using less energy overall to go through the water. So that can be new technologies like wind propulsion that can either extend the range of your batteries or, you know, mean that you're in the end, you're using less of the new fuels. Because we know that the new fuels, for example, are likely to be a bit more expensive. And so there's even more reason to think, hey, let's be really careful about burning them and use all these other technologies to, you know, to supplement its use.
Yeah. I suppose the short sea shipping takes has an advantage, doesn't it? Because those vessels spend more time in port. So we've written a bit on ship.energy about the increase in cold ironing.
Yeah.
So you've got renewably generated electricity that's available in port and you can plug in your ship and recharge it while it's spending time at berth. Then clearly that's quite a rapid route. And I think the technology is already there.
Yeah, definitely.
Prime Minister's just talked about a 30% increase in wind power by 2030.
Yeah.
Technologically achievable and economically possible. So those things can be done quite quickly, can't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the technology exists. There's just a few barriers. You know, at the moment, it's still cheaper for a ship to be using its auxiliary engines when it's in port than, you know, potentially buying the electricity because of a whole range of factors like tax or connection charges. So from a transport and environment perspective, we see that it's really important that EU steps in here and we have policies like a zero emission at berth standard. And this means that, you know, a ship coming into port has to be clean and they can choose how they're going to do that, either by plugging in or burning a renewable fuel on board instead in order to meet that goal, and see that as being a really important first step, this thin end of the wedge to enable us to start scaling up these technologies to decarbonize the sector.
Mm. There are, of course, as you say, there's probably lots of different routes and it depends on the ship size and where it's trading and what cargo it's trading and so on. But what about carbon capture as a way of decarbonizing shipping? Because there's divided opinion on this, isn't there? Some people who call themselves pragmatists will say, well, we'll consider anything that meets the end goal, which is to reduce carbon emissions one way or another from shipping. Whilst there are others who we might describe as sort of more environmental puritans or zealots who reject carbon capture as being against the spirit of decarbonization in the same way that some people reject scrubbers. It's the spirit of desulfurization because you're just taking the scrubber out of one environment, the atmosphere, and putting it into another, you know, either directly into the ocean or into some sort of tank where you later pour it away into the ocean. So do you think carbon capture has a role?
We think probably not. So we have seen the new announcements about carbon capture on board. We don't think it's particularly realistic. We know that these systems will increase the energy demand of the vessel in of itself, and also, you know, potentially losing valuable cargo space. Also, it's basically keeping fossil fuels in business, and definitely our position is we want to replace fossil fuels with cleaner renewable fuels. So ultimately, we don't see it as a particularly great solution. We think it's, you know, another one of these dead ends that doesn't make sense in the long run.
So we've got all these different potential solutions, you know, hydrogen or hydrogen carriers, batteries, maybe LNG or not on the way. Is there an even-handed way of saying, okay, everybody in shipping, you choose your solution, but we'll make it as easy as possible for you to do that by treating you all the same? How are we able to do that?
Well, I mean, this is exactly what we've been arguing for at both an IMO and an EU level in our proposals. We've been calling for there to be like goal-based measures, for there to be targets of how much shipping must reduce its climate emissions by 2030, and saying, you know, there are all these different ways that we can meet those targets. Some of it can be operational. It can be around the behavior of the ship, like slow steaming, for example, doesn't require new technology, can dramatically reduce the overall emissions. Other things like the deployment of technology. And we see that as being really important, is setting a goal that has to be met. In an EU context, we're also arguing for, based on the data from the EU monitoring, reporting and verification that ships have to make every year, for there to be a carbon price paid into an ETS or ETS-like system, and then some of that money being used for a maritime or ocean fund to be able to invest in the new technologies that are needed to decarbonize the sector. So on one hand, setting a goal, saying, here's the goal, lots of different ways you can meet it. On the other hand, to pays principle, get some cash in a fund. Companies can then apply for subsidies in order to deploy those technologies in order to meet that goal for their fleet. And, you know, this kind of two-pronged approach to get us where we need to be. And, and that's incorporated into those proposals is also this zero emission berth standard that I mentioned before, as being like, this is a place that we can really start today on that journey. And I think this, you know, this is, would be, you know, really fantastic. We would see lots of different new ship types. You know, we'd be able to trial new technologies. We would be able to like learn which technologies really perform well in the real world. We would also be, if we're doing it from the EU context, these EU regulations, we would then be first movers that would enable like other parts of the world to see, hey, this is what works, and then we can follow. So it's a way of taking a regional approach to meet the global goals and to start that transition and to take people with us. 20% of our global trade is trade related to the EU market. So, you know, that is quite a substantial part. And we have a lot of the technologies here. We can be supporting supporting businesses here with the new technologies, creating jobs in the shipping industry. So I see that as a really essential part of meeting our global commitments.
It's you mentioned the European Union's ETS and saying something like that could be applicable to shipping. And of course, the ETS applies mostly to land-based stationary things like power plants or chemical industries and so on, but also to other transport sectors. So, you know, road and rail, doesn't it? And there's aviation's included in the ETS now, I think.
Intra-EU, not extra-EU, but that's also being debated in the next round of the ETS.
You mentioned the European ETS, which applies, of course, mostly to stationary industrial activity on land, so power plants or chemical industries and so on. Also covers other transport sectors, road, rail. I think aviation within the European Union is covered by the ETS. Does any of the work you're doing at T&E, do you find that there are applications for non-maritime transport that can be transferred over into the maritime space?
definitely. I think the work that's been done on decarbonising road vehicles, like the electrification story for cars, we see that, you know, it's very similar technology. You know, we've seen all of these innovations in battery capacity, and that means that it's now a serious consideration that we can use batteries for ships. I think 20 years ago, even like 5 years ago, everybody thought that this was like quite an impossible idea, but we've seen like huge innovations in the technology. Yeah, electrification of ships is a possibility, and also the developments for hydrogen. But in fact, you know, we were even like looking a little bit back to the past, because, you know, back during the war, apparently Belgium was powering its buses on ammonia because they didn't have oil. And we're now looking at ammonia for shipping. So it isn't just in the recent years. It's like, you know, some of the stories in history tell us or give us some ideas of what could be solutions for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. The future will get to us in its own time. As for the present, we're about bumping up against our time limit. So just before we round up, I would just wonder if there's any other work or publications that you're working on at the moment or have released that you want to highlight at this point before we...
Our main work now is around the next round of greenhouse gas negotiations at the IMO. We're really, really hoping that we get something meaningful in terms of short-term measures to decarbonize shipping, and that we actually see meaningful reductions in emissions by 2023 and 2030. So that's our big priority in the run-up to meetings in October and November. And then also the next phase of the EU shipping campaign. We've now had a really positive result in the European Parliament. And so we're just looking to build support in the European Commission and European Council to take the next steps to provide this pathway for EU shipping to decarbonise.
Great. Well, we'll be happy to monitor those developments and your own contributions to them. Dr. Lucy Gilliam, it's been great to have you on board, fluent and eloquent as ever. Thank you so much for agreeing to appear on our homely little podcast, and best of luck with all of your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.